The Democrats have taken a very sharp turn to the left, especially under Obama. They tried to patch it up by clearing the playing field and putting in Biden, who's overwhelmed by the issues we face. And that lays the groundwork for a Reagan-type victory that allows you to make the kind of significant changes and institutional changes that have to occur.
For 4 years, the media and Democrats claimed that Donald Trump was a Russian tool.
The Russians offered help. The campaign accepted help. The Russians gave help, and the president made full use of that help. And that is pretty damning, whether it is...
That assessment was based largely on empty allegations planted by allies of the Hillary Clinton campaign. Those allegations provided the basis for spying on members of Trump's campaign and served as the predicate for a years-long investigation by Robert Mueller and America's intelligence apparatus. This specious theory became known as Russiagate. And now Russiagate itself is under investigation by special counsel John Durham. To ensure Durham's work would continue after Trump's term, then Attorney General William Barr appointed him that status of special counsel. Looking into the origins of these lies and finding the truth was the chief task for AG Barr. William Barr is no stranger to the Department of Justice, having spent time at the DOJ during Reagan's and H.W. Bush's presidencies. He is, in fact, one of only two people to hold the role of Attorney General twice. His record is characterized by tough on crime policy, as well as a strict constitutional interpretation of the law. Attorney General Barr's new book, One Damn Thing After Another, chronicles the roller coaster of events while he was the AG under President Trump, the aforementioned Russian collusion fabrication, COVID, the Black Lives Matter riots, the 2020 election. We will discuss all of it. Plus, we'll get his thoughts on the unprecedented leak from the Supreme Court and the current Department of Justice's January 6th investigations and arrests. In this episode, Attorney General Barr joins to break down the difference between actual crimes and the media's constant hysteria. Hey, and welcome. This is the Ben Shapiro Show Sunday Special. This show is sponsored by ExpressVPN. Protect your online privacy today at expressvpn.com/Ben. Just a reminder, we'll be doing some bonus questions at the end with the Attorney General. The only way to get access to that part of the conversation is to become a member. Head on over to dailywire.com, become a member. You'll have access to all of the full conversations with every one of our awesome guests. Attorney General Barr, thanks so much for joining the show. Really appreciate it.
Good to be here, Ben. Thanks for having me.
So why don't we begin sort of with the role of the DOJ in general. So you served as Attorney General twice. You did it in the H.W. Bush administration and, of course, under Donald Trump. And there seems to be sort of widespread misperception about what the Attorney General does. On the one hand, the Attorney General is expected by whoever the president's supporters are to be the wingman for the president. On the other hand, the Attorney General is expected to be some sort of independent agent who is just there to establish justice on his own. What is the actual law with regard to what your role was as Attorney General?
Well, there are basically three functions. One is a policy advisor on the justice system, including criminal justice. And there you're a political appointee providing advice as to the president's political program, his policy program. The other is providing legal advice to the president and the executive branch. And you do that, again, as a presidential subordinate who's providing advice from the standpoint of someone who's in sympathy with the administration's program. And you try to help the administration attain its objectives within the law. And then the third role is administering the criminal justice system, chief prosecutor, essentially. And there you are subordinate to the president. But attorneys general generally believe and should attempt to administer the criminal justice system without regard to partisan feelings and apply one standard of justice for everybody. That's what the rule of law is all about. Now, that doesn't mean the president can't say, you know, I'd like you to pursue, you know, these kinds of crimes aggressively, or, you know, I just saw something on television that bothers me. Someone was beaten up. Are you looking into that? That's fine. But if the president starts intervening and directing that certain people be prosecuted, regardless of what the attorney general thinks the evidence is and the law is, then that would generally be considered an abuse. And I wouldn't do it. And I don't think most attorneys general should or would.
Why don't we go back to when you were first asked by President Trump to become attorney general? So immediately preceding that, he'd had Jeff Sessions as his attorney general. He had moved sort of along a broad spectrum of feelings about Jeff Sessions. Sessions was one of his earliest supporters, obviously, when he was senator from Alabama. And then when Sessions recused himself during the Russiagate investigation, this angered President Trump. Why don't we start from your perspective as somebody who actually served as Attorney General on whether it was right for Jeff Sessions to recuse himself in the Russia investigation in the first place, which sort of led to this chain of events.
I think that he was right in recusing himself from parts of it, but I think he had a very sweeping general recusal that probably went too far.
So when it comes to, so President Trump basically became very angry with Sessions for doing this, and eventually Sessions left, and then you get the call that the president wants you to become the Attorney General. What are your thoughts when you get that call?
Well, I was very reluctant to do it. I was in a very good place where I wanted to be entering retirement, and my family was not keen on the idea. I was under no illusions about Trump's personality and his the way he treated lawyers. All my business, I had never met him, but all my business friends in New York who had worked with him said that I should stay away. But I wasn't going in to be the buddy of the president. I felt that we were headed toward a potential constitutional crisis. I was skeptical of the Russiagate matter, and I thought that that could be essentially being used as a weapon to hobble the administration and drive the president from office. And so I thought there was a potential crisis coming up. Also, the Department of Justice and the FBI were being buffeted, under attack from both sides. And I felt someone had to go in there and steady the ship. And I tried to propose other people, but no one else got traction. And eventually I decided that if the president asked me, I really had to do it. And it's sort of summed up in the advice some of my colleagues from the Bush administration gave me, which is, look, the country's facing some challenges. And what's important for the country is that somebody have these jobs and know what they're doing. And so I said that I would accept it if offered, and he did offer me the job.
So why don't we talk about Russiagate? Because obviously that played a major role in your decision to take the job in the first place. So Russiagate, obviously originated in 2015, 2016, with all these allegations that the president of the United States, at that point just a candidate, was colluding with the Russians in order to skew the outcome of the election. This led to a series of abuses, including FISA warrants against Carter Page that were, it appears, entirely unsubstantiated. It led to the release via a very sort of jerry-rigged process of the completely unsubstantiated, so far, Steele dossier, which turns out to now be basically just a bunch of garbage rumor mongering that was trafficked in Washington, D.C., and then eventually laundered into the FBI. What was your perspective on Russiagate from the outset, and sort of how did it evolve, and then how did you treat that as Attorney General?
So when it first came up, I was skeptical of it because from my experience, I didn't think the Russians would need to collude with anyone or want to collude with anyone in the United States in order to carry out a hack and dump operation, which is essentially what it was, stealing emails and dumping them into the public forum. And, the more I found out about it, the more I became skeptical of it. I looked at the dossier when it first came out, and to me it was a joke. And I think a number of professional intelligence people over at the agency, the CIA, just felt it was garbage. So I always felt it hard to explain why the FBI was following up the way they did on it, both before the election, but particularly after the election, when they started finding out what a piece of rubbish it was. They seemed to double down.
And I want to, in just 1 second, get to sort of the release of the Steele dossier, which seems pretty suspicious in terms of how that was actually released. First, you're probably overpaying for your home and auto insurance. You just are. I mean, you're paying too much because you did it through word of mouth, didn't you? Well, with home and auto insurance rates on the rise industry-wide, now is the time to make sure you are not overpaying for your coverage. Policy Genius is your one-stop shop to find the insurance you need. Just head on over to policygenius.com, answer a few questions. Policy Genius will show you price estimates for policies that fit your search. The team will look for ways to save you more money. If you like what they find, they will get you switched over for free. Customers who bundled their home and auto policies with Policy Genius saved an average of $1,250 per year over what they were paying. The Policy Genius team works for you without bias or favor to any one insurance company. Even after you're covered, Policy Genius offers claims, support, and easy reshopping to find savings when it's time to renew. Policy Genius does not add extra fees. They're not going to sell your information to third parties. Their top-notch service has earned them thousands of five-star reviews across Google and Trustpilot. So go check them out right now. PolicyGenius.com. Get your free home insurance quotes. See how much you could save. Do not spend too much money on home, life insurance, auto insurance. Instead, get all your insurance needs fulfilled at PolicyGenius.com. They are the place to get the insurance you need. PolicyGenius.com to get your free home insurance quote today. See how much you could save. So, Attorney General Barr, you know, when the Steele dossier was released, the sort of lead up to the release was very suspicious. You had James Comey, who's the head of the FBI, coming and presenting President Trump with the news that there was this Steele dossier and it was floating around. And Mr. President, you need to know about this thing. And then almost simultaneous with that, BuzzFeed releases the full entirety of the Steele dossier and uses as the news hook the fact that Comey has now told the President of the United States about all this. All of this seems really, really suspicious. And then we learn, of course, that there have been coordinations between members of the media and people who are working within the FBI on some of this stuff. You know, I'll admit that as a conservative, I tend to be somewhat of an institutionalist, and it really undermined a lot of my trust in places like the FBI.
Well, I've frequently said that January 6th to me was a very important date, and I'm talking about January 6th, 2017, when they had that the intelligence people went in to brief the president-elect. And as you said, even Comey's own memo say that he advised the president that CNN was just looking for a news hook to go with the dossier. And then right after that meeting, they seem to have gotten the news hook and reported on the dossier. And not even the parts of the dossier that, including parts of the dossier that were not raised with the president-elect. So I've been very suspicious of that meeting, for obvious reasons. I'm wondering what games, or I'm concerned about what games were being played at that point, not just by the Hillary campaign and the people trying to explain her defeat, but also by the senior levels of the FBI. But that's what Durham is designed to get to the bottom of.
So a lot of folks on the right are, I would say, annoyed that there have been no prosecutions of anyone in the Hillary camp or anyone in the FBI over any of this. There's been people who have been losing their jobs, temporarily losing their pensions in some cases, but there haven't been any sort of top level prosecutions of any of the named people in these particular areas. Do you foresee that there will be, or do you think that this is sort of going to come to a quieter terminus?
I'm hopeful there'll be a thoroughgoing report, and to the extent he can prove any cases, I think he will not hesitate to pursue them. But I am a little tired of hearing that from people in my own party, because you have to remember that Durham did not get access to the IG's report, and the IG did not complete his report until December of 2019. The end of 2019 is when he got the big data dump. And before that, he was working on other aspects of Russiagate, like, you know, whether the foreign intelligence services were involved. So at the end of 2019, he gets into the FBI part of it. And then what happens 3 months later? COVID, which shuts down all the grand juries across the country. What that means is no one's going to come in voluntarily, because they know you cannot go to a grand jury and get a subpoena. And so they'll just say, look, I'm not going to talk to you voluntarily, period. So the investigation was dramatically slowed down because of COVID, and that didn't lift until October of the election year. So I'm not very sympathetic to people who complain that more progress was made. And I try to explain to them the criminal justice process. There are two things about it that don't make it a useful political weapon. One is, if done right, it's secret. You don't find out about what's going on. And number two, it takes a while, especially in this kind of case where you don't have an overt act like burning documents or something like that. You're basically saying the person acted with corrupt intent. They were doing something they have the power to do, like looking for a spy, but they had corrupt intent. And that's a very difficult case to put together.
So Attorney General Barr, when you take office, you know, obviously, this is part of the task that you're given. But the other part of the task is to advise the President of the United States. You mentioned that his personality is pretty unique. What was it like working with President Trump? You're trying to, you know, bring about, I think, a certain level of stability in the AG's office. What was that like on a day-to-day basis?
Well, on what I call the red meat issues, the issues where he had a good sense of what the right thing to do was, and you know, that conformed to my views of good policy on being tough on crime, of getting control over the border, going after Chinese espionage in the United States, going after the drug cartels. On those issues, he was great. He let me and the department do our thing. He gave us his support and backing, and he was very pleasant to deal with, especially during the first year. But as he went into the election year, he didn't, you know, the liberal view or the Democrats try to portray him as sort of controlling the Justice Department. Actually, he kept his word to me, and his word was when I agreed to serve that he would not discuss criminal cases with me. And he didn't. But what he did was tweet and go on news shows and start talking about, you know, if Bill Barr wants to go down in history is great, and instead of just a nebbish, he's going to go after Biden, and Biden is a criminal and Obama's a criminal, and that put me in a difficult position. And he was frustrated because he wanted to see some scalps, obviously, during the election year, and we were not in a position to deliver them and still do our job at the Justice Department.
Yeah, Attorney General Barr, it seems like one of the things that was kind of a repeated motif during the administration, it was from virtually every department, is that very often the president would have sort of these ideas that broke taboos or that were not good. And advisors would say, we're just not going to do that. And there was some hotly fought conflict over that. And then it seems almost in virtually all cases, with a few exceptions, which we'll talk about, the president basically backed down. Like once he was told you're not allowed to do X, he actually would not do X. And then there'd be a news report about how he had considered doing X, but then he was dissuaded from doing so. But it seems like in the vast majority of cases, when he was told by his advisors that this is either a bad idea or this violates the law, that he didn't then just go forward with it. And so most of the news coverage tended to be about the things that he was thinking and the considerations of doing it as opposed to what he actually did.
That's absolutely right. The way I would sum up his administration is up until his defeat in the election, was that his impulsiveness did lend some dynamism to the administration. He was able to roll over the resistance and the obstruction and the inertia in the bureaucracy and in the political process. But the bad side of it was he would sometimes have very bad ideas. But in all of those cases, we could talk him out of going as far as he wanted and usually figure out a way to accomplish his objective within the law. And that's why I've said this whole idea that he was an autocrat is simply wrong. I mean, he would agree with his advisors ultimately. We'd litigate it. We'd win. You know, these things that have been attacked, like the travel ban or the wall or other things, we all won those cases.
So you mentioned before sort of the entrenched bureaucracy here, and there's an argument on the part of a lot of people on the right that there is, in a lot of these various branches of government, the so-called deep state. That's the phrase that's used. How true do you think it is that there are entrenched bureaucrats in positions of power who have been there for a lifetime and are innately opposed to the agenda, not just President Trump personally, but the agenda of people like President Trump makes it very hard to shift steer the ship of state in a different direction when you do take over? And how much did that hamper Trump?
I think it hampered him a great deal, and I do think there is a deep state. Now, it's not necessarily the people who've been there a long time, maybe some of them, but it's also younger people who have come in more recent years. And each agency has its share of the deep state. At the Department of Justice, one of the manifestations of it was leaks. I've said several times that criminal cases or criminal investigations that were embarrassing to the Republicans were leaked while I was there, whereas the cases that were embarrassing to Democrats were never leaked. And that's the difference. There were people trying to use the criminal justice process, just like this leak at the Supreme Court, to achieve their higher good, which is, they're the vanguard of history and nowhere to lead the country. And anything goes when when you have the high moral ground like that. I'm talking, of course, about the progressive mindset.
So in just one second, I want to get to fast forward to the Ukraine phone call, which leads to the first impeachment attempt against President Trump. First, let's talk about eating healthy. It is summer. That means it is time to barbecue. But everybody knows no barbecue is complete without the right sauces and dressings. Make sure you are fully stocked this summer with Tessemaze. They've got an unbelievable selection of dressings and dipping sauces. They make everything delicious. I mean, they can make salad delicious. I hate salad, but even Tessemaze can do that. Tessemaze is an American-made company started by three brothers with a dream to share their mom's recipes with the world. Tessemaze puts flavor and quality above all else. Because of that, they quickly became the number one organic dressing brand in America. All of their products are manufactured right here in the United States. How can I testify how good their products are? Because they have a wide variety of kosher products, like their avocado ranch and lemon garlic dressing and marinade. They also just released a brand new vegan ranch that you just have to try. Kids, parents, grandparents, everybody can agree on one thing. Tessemaze dressings are good on all the things. Dipping wings, pizza, you can pour it over a fresh salad. Tessemaze makes every meal better. It's a staple in the Shapiro household now. These guys are the embodiment of the American dream. They're bringing manufacturing back to America. Their products are awesome. Go to Tessemaze.com. Use promo code Ben for 15% off all of their amazing products. That's Tessemaze.com, promo code Ben. Attorney General Barr, one of the big crises of the administration, this happens within your first year and a half working with the administration, is that the president has this phone call with Vladimir Zelensky of Ukraine. He's obviously been tweeting, you mentioned earlier, about Hunter Biden and about Joe Biden, about the idea that there's a vast amount of corruption in Ukraine and that this had some impact on both the 2016 election and going forward, it was going to have impact on Joe Biden and his presidential possibilities in 2020. And there is this infamous phone call between him and Vladimir Zelensky. He describes it as a perfect phone call. His opponents suggest that he's threatening the president of Ukraine, that unless he finds some reason to essentially create a prosecution out of whatever is available against Hunter Biden, implicating Joe Biden, that the aid to Ukraine will go away. When were you first made aware of this, and what was your perspective on the phone call?
So I was not aware of the phone call at the time it was made. By the way, it was made right after Mueller's testimony on Capitol Hill, which was effectively the end of the Russiagate debacle. And then the very next day, he talked to Zelensky. I didn't hear about it until in August when it was raised with me. And information that there was a so-called whistleblower that had raised concerns about it.
And when you read the transcript, were you made aware of what had happened on the phone call before you read the transcript? How were you made kind of aware of the details of it?
No, I was told initially that that a whistleblower thinks that there was a violation of law, that the president had violated the law and was essentially soliciting a campaign contribution. And I looked at the transcript, as did others at Justice, and I thought that that, you know, it was a sort of an unseemly call, but it was not a crime. There was no violation of law. I was personally mad because in his typical sloppy fashion, he threw around my name and Giuliani's name interchangeably when we had very different roles and were involved in very different things. So that annoyed me, but I didn't recriminate it about it. I advised the president he should get the transcript out as quickly as possible, which he procrastinated on, and a big head of steam built up before he got out the transcript. The Justice Department didn't really play a role in the impeachment, but I felt the whole impeachment episode shows, I think, one of the president's weak points, which is that he sometimes gets these harebrained ideas, and when the apparatus in government says no, or won't pursue it to his satisfaction, he tries to set up a little skunk works of outsiders to run a play without the knowledge of people in the government, and it gets him in trouble sometimes. And this was one of those occasions. I thought the whole idea that getting the Ukrainian government to investigate the firing of Shokin and that somehow would be a big breakthrough in the campaign was stupid. So I think it was a harebrained scheme, and it was pursued in a very heavy-handed way.
So what was the sort of basic legal analysis where the DOJ decided this is not a crime, what happened on the phone call? Because, of course, the entire left then suggested that you were deeply corrupt for not prosecuting the president of the United States on the basis of the phone call.
Well, I've noticed that he hasn't been prosecuted by this administration. And if people thought there was a crime and they have evidence of it, I assume they would. They seem to be doing everything else they can to, you know, to hobble Trump. But no one has brought any charges. I just didn't think that that amounted to a crime.
So fast forward, we're now in COVID era. I mean, and really is the name of your book is One Damn Thing After Another. And that really is, I mean, this 2.5 year period or 2 year period of your life, it's about 80 years, it sounds like, in terms of personal experience. But about 5 seconds after the Ukraine phone call happens and the impeachment happens, we get the outbreak of COVID. I mean, it's really just a couple of months later. And now there are all of these legal issues that are cropping up in terms of what the federal government can do, in terms of what the federal government should do. What was the position inside the administration? What were the discussions like inside the administration as far as the power of the federal government to leverage its authority to do all the things that it ended up doing?
Well, you know, I think most people, and I wasn't directly involved or didn't have a big role in the main issues involving COVID, but I think most people felt that we're a federal system, and at the end of the day, the president is going to have to work with the governors. The states have so-called police power. They have the primary duty of protecting the health and safety of their citizens. And I think